I'm Ray Moss, and I'm a responsible alcoholic. Well, I'm glad that Sunday finally came. I've been waiting since Dupree started the other night, and Dupree, I want to tell you, I've never been so inspired to get a meeting started as I was the other evening. You folks put together something that I know wasn't planned, but it certainly inspired me, and it just kicked me off to believe that this was going to be a great weekend, and has been probably one of the best weekends I've ever had in any place I've ever been. I drove through the doors of this place, and I'm a Methodist, and I began to feel, I'd never been here, and I began to feel something about the connectional system that Methodism has. I began to feel something about the warmth that Methodism talks about in the warmness of the heart. And then when I met some of you new friends, many of you I did not know, I began to sense that when you put together something that's been a part of your life for a long time, like the Methodist Church, along with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's been a part of my life for a long time, then you surely can't do anything but be a winner. And what a marvelous week it's been. I've felt the presence and the power of God in my life here that I've not felt in a long time. And I'm indebted to Flo and the committee and every one of them for offering me the opportunity and giving Betty and I a chance to be here and to see a lot of old friends and to meet some new people. Met a young man from California who's been an inspiration to me, and I wouldn't have gotten to meet James if I hadn't have been here, and a lot of other people. So I want to thank you. Bob Polk is a good friend of mine. He and Ruth, and we've been friends for a long time. And Bob always says this to me, and it kind of puts me off track, and I have to take a minute to get back on. He said to me, "Ray, we only got an hour and a half tape." I don't have any idea what Bob meant by that statement, but I'll assure you, Bob, that we'll stay within that limit. Bob introduced me to tapes a long time ago. I've always run into new things in my recovery, and Bob introduced me to tapes, and he helped me understand that there's a lot of messages that I can't ever hear from AA people that come around the country. And I got introduced to hearing tapes of people that I'd never known, and it's amazing when you finally see those people, and you think, well, you know, I know a lot about them, and they don't even know me. I heard Dupree's tape, and I'd never met Dupree. And then when I saw him, I thought, I couldn't imagine him looking like that. He doesn't look like an alcoholic. He just doesn't. But his story related to me some good stuff that I've heard. And I wanted to thank Bob again for introducing me. If you've never gotten tapes in your recovery, you ought to do that. They're a real part of my life and a part of a lot of other people's lives. It was February the 6th, 1980. Two or three days prior to that date, those few people that were left in my life were meeting together. And I'm convinced today that it was the power of God, as I now understand Him, that put those few people together. You see, they were trying to figure out, what can we do with Ray? And some of you know what I'm talking about. What can we do with him? Now, they meant, do something with him if it's not anything but just get him out of our lives. And by a miracle that came from God's hand, an old boy came about 60 miles from where I was living, and I hadn't seen this guy in a long time. And they hadn't seen him. My only friend and my wife called him, and Bob came, and Bob was going to take me and did take me to a hospital. Now, I didn't know that this was a different hospital than any of I'd ever been in before. But when Bob came, he got me in his car, and we started out on a journey of about 75 miles. I don't recall a lot of it because I'd been extremely drunk for many days. But I do recall Bob telling me about what had happened to him. See, Bob was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know it. And Bob was sober, and I didn't know it. I had drunk a lot of liquor with Bob, and we had had a lot of good times, I thought, together. But he came that day, and we rode that distance. Now, he didn't do what a lot of other people had been doing. Bob didn't kick my butt. He wasn't hard on me. He didn't give me any difficulty. He just simply told me what had happened to him. And I began to listen. Now, by the time I got to the hospital where I was going, I was drunk. You know, most of us arrive at those places drunk. And I woke up the next morning. I came to. I knew it was a hospital. I'd been in a lot of them. I never made a jail in my life, but I made a lot of hospitals. I looked around that hospital room, and I didn't remember the day before that, and I didn't remember much that had taken place. I couldn't recall much about what Bob had told me, but I knew it was a hospital, and I had gotten out of a lot of hospitals before, and all I had to do was find out what the doctor's name was and where I was, and I could usually leave. And that was part of my plan. I don't know about you, but it's kind of hard to make a decision that you're going to ask someone where you are and try to do it without them knowing that you don't know. Now, that's extremely difficult. I heard some fellas say, well, I looked at newspapers and found out what town I was in. Well, there wasn't a paper in there, and there wasn't a television. I thought it was a state hospital. So I just said, well, as soon as somebody walks in the door, I'm going to just, best I can, as cool as I can and as calmly as I can, just ask them where I am. And this beautiful little girl with a nursing uniform walked through the door, walked over to my bed, and I said, can you tell me where I am? That's the only way I knew to do it. And this is what she said. She said, Reverend Moss, when you were my mom and daddy's preacher, and I thought I'd die, I wanted to just go away. And I said to her, honey, just tell me where I am. I never found out who her mom and daddy was. I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. All those years had caught up with me. The next morning, a young doctor came and, well, he was young when I knew him before, but a doctor came and sat down on the side of my bed. And he said to me, Ray, I'm an alcoholic and I know how you feel. Now, coming down the road, old Bob had told me that he understood me. He said, Ray, I know how you feel. And now the doctor, who I had known 19 years prior to that date, was now telling me that he knew how I felt. He said to me, I'm going to send you to a treatment program. I never felt so bad in all my life. I had lost everything that I had ever owned. I had lost the family. They were gone. The children had nothing to do with me. My wife had left me again. I was a failure. You see, I had not always been that way. I once was able to stand tall among men. I was a leading young clergyman in the United Methodist Church in North Carolina. I was on whatever up is in the church. I was on that journey upward. And now I was, as Dr. Bob said to me, Ray, I'm an alcoholic. I know how you feel. And he didn't call me one, but I knew that I was. Alcohol's always been a part of my life. Cliff said something that he had heard somebody say that it started off way back yonder. My dad was in recovery the last 6 years of his life, and we got to talk a lot together. And I said to him, he was a periodic drunk, and told me he drank for 62 years alcoholically. And I said to him, Daddy, you think that you were drunk when I was conceived? And he said, no doubt about it, I was drunk all the time. So alcohol has always been a part of my life. Good, bad, it's been a part of my life. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in a little mill village. My dad was a mill village worker. My granddad worked in the cotton mill. And we lived in a little mill village house. And my dad was a periodic drunk. and he would go several weeks and never take a drink, but when he took one, he stayed on one. We lived in a little house and had a little pantry. I'm not sure if you understand what a meal house is, but it's four rooms and a little pantry off the kitchen. My dad could not drink in that house. Mama wouldn't let him, but he could drink in the pantry. And he would go in when he would start one of his trips into getting drunk. He'd buy his booze and put it in there, and then he'd go in and shut that door. And I'd hear him moving around in that kitchen or that little pantry. And after two or three trips, he'd get feeling good, and he'd leave the door open, and I'd watch him. And I learned how to drink from him. I learned a lot from my daddy, but the one thing that I did learn was how to drink. I never changed my pattern across the years. What I wanted to do was be like him when he first started drinking. Long before he got mean as hell, you know. After a while he'd get mean, but when he'd had a few drinks, he'd want to dance with Mama. And he'd pat her on the butt and try to get her to the dance, and she wouldn't dance. And after a while he'd get a broom and dance around the kitchen with the broom. And I thought, that's the craziest old man I have ever known in my life. I'm here to tell you this morning, I drank a lot of liquor by myself, and I danced with a lot of brooms, like my daddy. I learned to drink like my dad, and my first drink was like my daddy drank, and it was like this, and I'll never want to forget it. Mama was gone, and Dad was gone, and I went to the pantry where I knew he kept it. It was down in the very end of the pantry, on the floor, in a brown paper bag. And I did just like I saw him do. I stripped the bag down, unscrewed the top, turned it straight up, shook like a dog and said, "Damn, that's good," because that's the way Daddy did it. Now, let me tell you what it did for me. It did the same thing the first drink to the very last drink, till it quit working. I didn't like it. It didn't taste good. It's probably some cheap stuff. But it did some marvelous things for me. I hated my dad. I hated him worse than any other man in the world, because when he was drunk, hell took place in our family. And I didn't like my mama either. And I didn't like where I lived. I didn't want to be a lint head, and I didn't want to be in a cotton mill town, and I didn't want to live there. I just didn't like anybody. I didn't like myself. But when that drink hit my stomach and moved out into my arms, my dad was all right. Mama wasn't so bad. Hell, it wasn't bad living in a cotton mill town, and I didn't mind being poor when I had a drink. And that's what it did for me then, and that's exactly what I used it for across the years. I met a young lady when I was just 17, and she was about 17. And we got married right after we turned 18. She was the prettiest thing in my hometown. Still is. And she lived on the other side of town. Now, my little hometown of Kannapolis, North Carolina, railroad tracks run right down through the middle of it. And there is not any difference from the east side to the west side, except on the west side of town is where the mill village is, and I hated that place. And this woman didn't live in the mill village, and I thought she was rich. So I went after her and got her, and we were married. I drank an awful lot of liquor from the time I took that first drink till I met Betty. I had already experienced what most of us experience, blackouts, being asked not to come back to school, being sent home, being reported drunk, being locked up in my little town for having been drunk and disorderly. I'd already experienced those things, but when I met Betty, she didn't like anybody to drink, and certainly didn't like me drinking, and I just didn't do it. But when I did, on occasions, I got drunk. Betty and I had been married a few years, and we had a daughter, and something happened to me. I'd never been to church. You see, my folks didn't go to church, and I didn't go to church, so church wasn't a part of my life. But along about age 23, God got me from the rear end. I didn't know anything about Him. But he got me from the rear end, and I had what is best described up in Greenville, where we have the buckle of the Bible Belt. I had a religious experience. I can say it better. I was saved, and you'll understand it. God altered my life completely, 180 degrees. And Betty and I both became involved in the church. And about a year and a half so later, coupled with that conversion experience, was a call to the Christian ministry. Now, I'd quit high school when I was 16, and I did something I said I never would do, and that's go to work in the cotton mill. I didn't have an education. I had to go back to school, start back to high school, and I had a child. We had one child. And then on to college, then on seminary. I was a student pastor. That meant I had a couple of churches, and I was going to school full time. And I was going to graduate school at Duke University, driving back and forth about 50 miles each way. Had two big old Methodist churches out in the country, and a lot of people dying, a lot of people wanting to get married, and had to preach every Sunday, and just a whole lot of work at school. I was playing golf with a young doctor one Saturday, and I said, Bob, I'm having trouble sleeping. And he said, why don't you come by my office and I'll give you something. Now, I hadn't been drinking any for over 12 years. I'd never used any medication in my life. And I went by his office, and he gave me a little yellow, or a prescription for a little yellow Sinconal sleeping capsule. For 12, 13 years, I had been an honest, dedicated, consecrated Christian young man. Betty and I were dedicated people. I took that pill, and it did for me exactly what needed to be done. It put me to sleep. Wasn't nothing wrong with that. Somewhere in my genetic makeup has a gene gone wild, and I'm an alcoholic. Nobody told me that. I didn't know it. In a little while, maybe 6 months or less, one pill wouldn't do it. I couldn't go to sleep with one pill. And I did something that I hadn't done in years. I went back to see that doctor, and I said, Bob, I lost that. No, I said, Betty threw that prescription away. I can't find the bottle. And he said, that's not a problem. I'll give you another one. Now, I've got two prescriptions, one doctor, and two drugstores. And I'm starting on a journey that 19 years later took me to hell. I didn't drink for a long time, but I took a lot of pills for a long time. And the reason I didn't drink is that I was a Methodist and I was opposed to drinking. I preached a lot of sermons against alcohol and the evils of alcohol. Signed a lot of pledge cards. Jody, you know what I'm talking about. Signed a lot of pledge cards at the altar of the church saying, I'll never drink. I will not drink. And I didn't intend to drink. I moved from the pulpit ministry in the early 70s because I could no longer preach down to people. I didn't have much to say to them. I was doing about everything I was preaching against. And I asked the bishop to send me to another appointment, to a special appointment, to an urban ministry. We called it an inner city ministry in the late 60s. And he did it. And it was there that I did not have to preach to people. I worked with unwed mothers, unwed fathers, alcoholics, drug addicts, low-income people. See, I wasn't preaching down anymore, and I could do that. Now, I got introduced to alcohol again in my life. It was a drug of choice. I loved it. It did things that I liked. It took away the pain. I was at a meeting once with some attorneys and business people, and I didn't drink at that time. And they said, Ray, you drank? And I thought, well, I believe I'll just have a drink. And I did. And that started me on another new journey. Now, it turned on lights that I never had turned on before. When you're mixing up a bunch of stuff, you know, you go crazy. And literally went crazy. One evening I said to my wife, Betty, I don't love you anymore. Now, it wasn't that I didn't love her. I just didn't know how to love her. she was still that wonderful lady that I'd married and beautiful woman who was dedicated and consecrated to her faith, and I was totally insane with my addiction, and I couldn't love her. Didn't know how to love her. It's hard to love someone when you tell them you don't love them. So that started us into a terrible journey of in and out of our relationship or our marriage. Eventually, we just got a divorce. I was working for the state of North Carolina at that time, and Betty and I had separated again, and everybody I worked with the state had a divorce. This was mid-70s, and I thought, well, I ought to get me one, too. And I did. And then I lived alone. I moved out of where we were living. You see, I got married when I was just 18, a little older. I had never had the opportunity to be a swinger. And when I left Betty and we were headed toward our divorce, I decided that I'd get me an apartment in a swinging singles complex. And I did. And I moved in. Now let me tell you a little something about the way I swung. You see, I'd never been to a swinger. I didn't know anything about it. And this was a beautiful, beautiful arrangement. And the only person that I had did anything with was one guy came over one night, a Methodist minister. We went down and played bingo at the clubhouse. But one of the most important things that came out of that experience for me in my recovery today is that I understood that I had not progressed from taking the first drink as far as learning how to drink from the first drink to then. I said to myself, there's two things I'm going to have. I'm going to have a nice apartment where I can bring a lot of women in. And I'm going to have a bar. By golly, they don't allow Methodist preachers to bring bars in the Methodist parsonages. And I was going to have me a bar. And I went out the day I left my family, show you how insane I was, I went to and bought me a bar, a nice one. It was a imitation leather, but it was at least upholstered, and had two stools. And then I got me a cart in one of these self-service ABC stores, and I was no longer tied to anybody, and I was no longer had a congregation, and by golly, I could buy liquor if I wanted to, and the freedom of it to put it in a cart and push around the store. And I just wished somebody would come in and see me. And nobody came. But I bought all kind of stuff. Now listen, I never learned how to drink. I didn't know one name of anything. I just drank straight stuff. Didn't mix it. I turned it up, drank it. Filled that cart up and I went home and put it in the liquor cabinet. Let me tell you how I drank. I had a couple old chairs, the bed upstairs, a nice liquor cabinet. I'd sit in that old drinking chair. I'd go up into the bedroom. I'd reach back in the corner of that closet, pull that bottle out and fill me a glass full, put that bottle back and go back downstairs and sit down and drink it. And when that glass full was gone, I'd walk back up the steps, back in that corner, pour me a glass full. I never took a drink that I recall from the bar. I didn't know how to drink it. I just took the bottles upstairs because my daddy taught me how to drink, and it was straight out of the bottle. We have two children. I have a son. And Betty and I got a divorce. And if it had not been for that son, I guess Betty and I probably would not have had any contacts. But, you know, when you got a son, you have to talk to a lot and you have to take care of. Then you have communications with spouse. I moved from that swinging singles complex because I didn't swing any. And an old fellow told me once, he said, Ray, you probably didn't have any whip out. He was talking about money, of course, but didn't have the green stuff to do it. Well, whatever it was, I wasn't swinging much. So I moved over, and you know how we alcoholics are. I moved to the other side of town, to Greensboro, North Carolina, and I moved into a duplex apartment in a senior citizens community. You know how we go from one extreme to the other. One evening, nobody around there drank. One little lady next door to me would drink a couple of beers, and I'd invite her over. About 9 o'clock, she'd go home. And there I'd be by myself, and, you know, I'd reached that point in my life where I wanted to talk to somebody. You know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning when you're getting it going, you want to talk to people, and they don't want to talk to you. And Betty had ceased talking to me. She had said, I remember, if you call me again, I'll call the police. So I wasn't going to call her anymore. I'm sitting there thinking, how in the world can I get somebody here to talk to me as lonely as I am? I got up out of bed and picked up my double-barrel shotgun and loaded it with buckshot. I walked out to the front yard and I shot both windows out in that duplex apartment. I ran back in the house, crawled into bed, fell out on the floor, picked up the telephone, dialed the police and said, somebody's shooting at me. Now that's insanity, but that's where I was. About 3 minutes, 4 or 5 squad cars rolled up in the front yard. And they got out with their flashlights, ran all around the house, came inside, and I described it. You know how you know, if you're drinking and you want it to sound bigger, I just had a terrible description of it. And walked out on the front porch and must have been 75 little old men, women, most of them women out there in the front yard, wondering what in the world had happened. Now, let me tell you, I was not lonely about a month after that. For a month, there were enormous amount of people down my place talking to me. The little ladies were scared to death. They were wondering, Reverend, who do you think it might have been? You know, and so I had a lot of folks. Some of them drank with me. I remember the detective. They still looked into that for 2 or 3 weeks. And one evening he came by and he said to me as he walked out the house, Reverend, if I were you, I'd leave that man's wife alone. I tell you that because it took me a long time to tell that. I wouldn't hardly tell it. I told it in the fifth step, but I wouldn't tell it from the podium. But I need for you to understand how insane I got. I was working for the state, and it was a political appointment. And the politics were fixing to change in North Carolina, and I knew that my job would be gone. So I decided I'd go back and try to get back in the church. I had a glimpse of the past. I thought if I could just have a couple of little churches and put it back together like it used to be, maybe make things work, then my life would get back together. So I drove from Greensboro, North Carolina, down to Charlotte to see our bishop. The bishop of the Methodist Church is the leader of the church, and you have to talk to him if you want anything. So I went down to see him. He's a black Mississippi bishop. And I walked into his office, and he didn't know what I came for. But I sat down to talk with him, and I said, Bishop, I'd like to talk with you about getting a couple of churches. And he had my files on his desk, and they were thicker than the big book. And I'm sure most people's records were not that thick. He said, Brother Moss, you're divorced, aren't you? And I said, well, I am. And he said, well, I've never appointed a divorce minister to anything. And I said, you know, how quick we think on our feet. I said, Bishop, I'm fixing to get married. And he said, well, who are you going to marry? And I said, well, I'm fixing to marry my former wife, Betty. And this was a gracious old man. He said, you know, Ray, if you can do that, I'll give you a church. Well, I drove that 100 miles back to Greensboro with putting together a plan in my mind. How I could remarry Betty to get a church. Now, that's... I called her up and invited her to go out with me. I want to show you people who are in Al-Anon how crazy y'all got. And she accepted it, and we dated some. And one night when the lights were low, the wine was poured, I said to her, Betty, will you remarry me? And this shows you how crazy she was. She said, I will. And she did. Now, that's an experience in itself. My two children stood up for us. That's an experience. I had the district superintendent of the church to do it so I'd know the word got back to the bishop that I had remarried Betty. Now, I wasn't as crazy as some of you think I was. I didn't buy a new ring. I kept the old one. And we remarried. And we went to three little churches. Now, brother, let me tell you, when they give an alcoholic three of anything, it's something else. I'm still at the height of my drinking. I go out to these three little churches on the lake, beautiful little place, and I spent the next 3 years getting drunk. Now, it was a marvelous place to be because the people over here at this church would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you in a while. And I said, well, I've been visiting these people over here. And these people over here would say, Reverend, we haven't seen you in a while. And I said, well, I've been visiting these people over here. And I just kept it moving back and forth. And most of the time I was laid up down at the lake drunk. It was in that 3 year period of time that I did things that I took a long time for me to make amends for. I say it to you today because I have made my amends for it and it's cleaned up. But I buried people that I didn't know died during those years. I married young couples that I probably would be locked up for having lost their license had it not been for my wife keeping up with them. I stood in the sacred pulpit like this Sunday after Sunday preaching the Word of God that I thought was the Word of God. I administered the Holy Sacrament drunk Sunday after Sunday. I got through with a talk once and a woman came up to me and said, Reverend, how did you do that? And I said, honey, what do you do? She said, I'm a school teacher. I said, you ever go to school drunk? Well, yeah. Not any different. You see, I had to do what I had to do. I had to survive, and drinking was the only way I could survive. Now, what took place in my life across those 3 years, I continued to get sicker and sicker. And the family got sicker. And it was after that 3 year period of time that my wife and the only friend I have got together and made that decision to call Bob and get Bob to come down to see if he could take care of me. I see, prior to that, just about 3 weeks prior to that date, I had been in a psychiatric hospital, which was the third visit, one of the best in the country, they told me. And I was back there for the second time. Now, what I got out of that psychiatric hospital, and Cliff and I talked about this the other night, and sitting on the prominent place in our home today is an 8-legged octopus. And we platted that rascal, I did, when I was in treatment. And it was in that therapy that I learned how to make an octopus. I didn't learn a thing in the world about alcoholism. I didn't learn a thing in the world about my insanity. I learned how to make an octopus. That son of a gun cost me $30,000. And I keep him sitting in the most prominent place in my house so that every morning when I get up, I look at him and I say, good morning, sir. I hope I never see you again. I was in that psychiatric hospital and it was had an adult ward and they had an adolescent wing. You know, they don't know what to do with alcoholics in psychiatric hospitals because we clean up so quickly. You know what happens? We just get detoxed and first thing you know, we're running the place. And they put me in charge of the adolescents. I think they thought I was a father figure to them, and so I was being cool, you know how you I was doing, being cool with those kids, and it snowed while I was there. And a big snow in February, and I said to the staff, you get us some buckets, and we'll go out and gather up some snow. We'll make snow cream. Now, these kids never heard about snow cream, and they thought that would be a marvelous, therapeutic thing to do. Well, we went out in the snow, and these kids got in a little powwow circle. And they lit up something, and I'm sitting in the middle of it with them, and they pass this stuff around. And I'm drinking already because I've got a pass now to go outside, and I can pick up a fifth and bring it back in. And I drank in that psychiatric hospital, and I'm now smoking something that the kids are smoking. I'm flying about 10 stories high in that building. And I think to my, God did for me what I wasn't able to do. I called the nurse did, and I called, she did, and I talked to the doctor, and I said, Doctor, I'm drinking more alcohol, and I'm using more drugs here than I did outside. And he said, Ray, that can't be true. I'm the chief of staff. And I said, well, brother, you better come on down. Next morning he came, and he was still arguing me that it couldn't happen. And I blew my breath in his face, and he wrote me a discharge. And that's when I wound up back in that old house with nobody but me. And then Bob came. And Bob took me to the detox. And Dr. Bob, who was the same doctor that 19 years prior to that had wrote me the prescription for the sleeping pill. Almost a miracle. Just a complete turn. Well, I got to treatment. I need to tell you a few minutes about treatment. I believe in treatment. I wish everybody could go, and it's not possible for everybody to go. I had to go. I would have never made it, I know, without going. Some people don't. But I had a marvelous experience, and on my first week there, I got well. You know, Dot, how that happens. I just got well. And I walked down to the counselor's office. My bags were packed, and I said, Dorothy, I'm going home. I want to thank you folks for getting me well. And thanked her, and she said to me, Ray, you're sicker than anybody I've ever seen. I want you to go down to your room, and I want you to pray about what you're doing. And I walked down the hall. I'd already gone, but I couldn't think of anybody to come get me. Nobody would listen to me anymore. But I sat down on the side of that bed, and two things came to my mind that I wish to God I had not had to think about, because I drank myself to sleep trying to forget them many nights. One of them was this. I got up one Sunday morning to go to a Methodist men's group across town to be the speaker, and I'd been drunk that night. Probably drunk late in the morning, early in the morning. I dressed and got in the car, and I stopped at a stop sign right above my house apartment at a hill. Wasn't a thing coming. The light was green or red, and I stopped. Light turned green, and I turned left, and I heard a bump about like that. I stopped my car and looked back, and a guy was lying in the road. And I was still drunk. And I said, that fool walked into my car. And when I got out, I had turned left in front of a big motorcycle. And this young man was convulsing. Every bone that I could see was broken. It seemed to me like it was an eternity before anybody came. He stayed in the hospital 6 months, almost died. I fed his children and his wife for that 6 months. I didn't get a ticket. The officer said, Reverend, where were you going? And I said, I was going, you know, explained it to him. I didn't get a ticket, but I was drunk. I drank myself to sleep trying to forget that. Another thought that came right back to back with that one was one morning my son woke me up, shook me out of a drunken stupor, and said to me, Dad, wake up. He was about 16 at that time. He said, Dad, you know what you did last night? And I had to admit that I didn't. He said, you slapped Mama. And I loaded my rifle and I was going to kid you. But Mama wouldn't let me. And I didn't do anything about that. I just drank to forget it. And I remembered those two things. And I got up off that bed and I walked down to Dorothy's office and I said, Dorothy, I'm going to stay. Now God did once again what needed to be done for me. And I finished my treatment. And that's all that it was. It wasn't recovery, it was treatment. I got in my automobile to leave on that March the 24th. And I drove about 50 miles to my superintendent's office. And I was a sober alcoholic now. And I was going to take my churches back and I was going to save the world. You know how we began the pink cloud. And I walked into his office and he said, Ray, the bishop and I have decided that we don't need your services. Now, he didn't say it quite that way, but he said, we're going to put you on leave of absence. Isn't that a kind way of letting you down? And I walked out of his office. I told him, I'm glad you did that, because that's what I was going to tell you. I wasn't honest. And I said, that's what I was going to tell you I wanted to have done. And I left there and I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. I'd spent every penny that I had. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a friend. I didn't have a family. I drove down to that little mill village where I was raised to my mama's house. I walked in and I said to her, Mama, I'd like to stay with you for a few days. And she said, well, you can sleep in the back room. There's not a bed back there, but you can sleep there if you want to. And I slept on the floor. Tell you what happened to me that March the 24th. I went to a meeting on by myself. I'd been to meetings in treatment. They took me to meetings. There's a difference. God, there's a difference. I didn't make that decision when I was in treatment. They just said, get ready, we're going. I said, I ain't going. And they said, well, you can't stay if you don't go. And I didn't have anywhere else to go, so I had to get ready and go to the meeting. But this was my choice, my meeting. I chose to go, and I opened the door and walked into the little fellowship hall of the Catholic Church in Kannapolis, North Carolina, scared to death. About 16 hands came out to meet me. God, they were glad to see me. They gave me their phone number, and they said, call us anytime, and we'll come help you, or you can come see us. I thought, these are the best people I've ever met. I couldn't believe it. Now, what I found out later was that I was the first newcomer that had walked in that building in years. And you know what alcoholics do to newcomers? And they grabbed a hold of me, and they did for me what needed to be done. And from that moment to this moment, there has never been a down day. Oh, I've had some days, but they've never been down. They've all been up. You see, I have rebounded to a height far greater than that which I fell from. I have been reintroduced to the God of my understanding, the God of my salvation, the God of AA, the God of the church that I understand. I found a new life. I've made new friends. I've got a new career. The church has accepted me back. Not only accepted me, I never applied. I just gave them up, and I just wasn't going to ask them to do anything. And they came to look for me. And they asked me if I would accept my reinstatement. And I accepted it. I have a relationship with the church now that's real and honest and open. They know that I'm an alcoholic. My bishop knows that I'm an alcoholic. I get a lot of calls from ministers wanting me to help them work with somebody and get them some help. I work with a lot of ministers themselves, families of the minister, a lot of church people. And God, as I understand Him, has given me that opportunity today. I've learned an awful lot in this fellowship. I tried to preach forgiveness for years. I didn't know a thing in the world about forgiveness. I thought I did, but I didn't. I'm going to tell you how I learned it. I learned from the fellowship of Al-Anon what forgiveness was. I was sober about 6 months, and I chose me a good sponsor. Now, George has never told me to do a thing. He's not one of those guys that gets a stick after you and tells you how to do it. He just simply showed me how to do it. And he said, we were talking, and he was telling me about his fourth step and his fifth step and how he had done it 20 years prior, 15 years prior. And he said, you made your amends? And I said, well, no, I haven't. He said, well, you've got to start. Well, I'd made my amends to Ray, and I thought that's about as far as I had to go. But he said, let's start off, and you start off with the person you've hurt the most, and that was Betty. And he said, you need to make your amends to her. Now, he said, Ray, be honest. Write them all down and share them all with her. Well, I'm still living at my mama's house, and it's hard as the devil to make amends and talk about things in your mama's house when she's all ears. So I invited Betty to go with me. Now, she didn't ride too close. She remembered when the light was low and the lamp was lit and the candle was burning and the wine was full. She didn't get too close to me. But we rode the meetings, and we stopped off at Burger King that night. And I said to her, and she'd been around long enough, she knew what I needed to do. And I got my papers out and laid them down, and I reached across the table and took her by the hand and said to her, Betty, I've hurt you in so many ways with my alcoholism, and I need to make amends to you. And I would have read every one of them. And she squeezed my hand and looked me straight in the eye and said to me, Ray, it's okay. About a year and a half after that, I was invited to speak at my home church in North Carolina, Methodist Church. First time I was asked to preach or speak in sobriety. And the minister wanted to know what you're going to talk about. It was in the Easter series. And I said, I'd like to talk about forgiveness. And I learned it, Abe, from Al-Anon. And it didn't come out of the Bible. Is it okay if I preach it that way? And I was able to do that. My daddy was an alcoholic. I've told you that. I hated him. He was in the Second World War for about 4 years. I prayed for him every day while he was gone. I prayed that the SOB would get killed. I lived with that for a long time. My dad got sober. He called me once, and I'd been in the program about five or six years, and he called me and said, "Son, I need to see you. I'm sick." And I thought he was just on a drunk. And I went to get him, see how he was doing, and he said to me, "First time ever, I've got a problem with drinking. I need your help." I picked his little tail up off the couch and threw him in the back seat of my car, and I took him to a treatment program. He stayed about 3 or 4 months. He was so sick. Well, he got sober, got in the program. He called me one day and said, "I need to see you." Well, you see, I knew enough about the program that I knew what he needed to do. I knew he needed to make amends. I drove up to North Carolina to visit with him. He's sitting at the table at my sister's house, little old arthritic body, and his hands were drawn with arthritis. My daddy had never let me hug him, and I'd never hugged him. He had never hugged me. He said to me, "When I was a boy, men don't hug and men don't cry." And I taught my son the same thing. And I went to see him, and I needed to make my amends to him. He reached his hands across the table and took mine in his and said to me, "Son, all those years that I wasn't a father, I need to tell you about it, and I want to make amends to you." I did exactly to him what Daddy did to me. I said to him, "Daddy, it's okay." I gave him his 6 sobriety chips. Every one that he picked up, I gave them to him. A man that I hated with a passion, I loved more than anything else. I was up in a store in North Carolina. We bought us a little house we were remodeling, and I was in a hardware a week or two ago, and a fella came over, and I didn't know, and he didn't know me, and he said, "Are you Joe Moss's son?" And I said, "Yeah, how'd you know that?" He said, "You look just like him, you talk just like him, and you walk just like him." And I said, "By God, I'm so grateful to know that. I love that man." That's what the program did, folks. It took hate and changed it to love. To tell you very quickly about my first birthday. My sponsor tells me if you can't remember your first birthday, you better go back and try. Now, I don't want to ever forget my first birthday. I've had some others, but this one was most important. There was 250 people there, and I thought every one of them came to see me get a chip. Now, that was not true, but I knew them all, and they had come to help me celebrate. My family was there. My wife was there. My children were there. My mother-in-law, my mother. You know, the people that you'd hurt the most were there just to see me pick up a chip. And when I asked old Bob to come down from High Point, North Carolina, he had the guy that took me to treatment to share his story. And after I picked that chip up, I looked around for my son. I couldn't find him. He's a strapping submariner. I knew where he was. He was outside because I taught him well, men don't cry. And I walked outside and I looked down across the parking lot under the lights. There he stood. And I walked toward him and he turned to walk toward me. And in the lights of that church building, or church parking lot, I reached out my arms and he reached out his. And we embraced and cried. And he said to me, "You're the best daddy that anybody could ever want." Not long before that, he had pulled a gun to kill me. Now, you see, all I had to do to get that was not drink, go to meetings, read the big book, work with other alcoholics, get a sponsor. The simplest things in the world to get the hardest thing in life, and that's respect from your children. I've got it so hard to get But living this program brings it back. Hardest thing I had to do, Jody, and you'll understand this, was to make amends to church people, the ones that I preached to drunk, ministered the sacrament to. I said to one preacher who followed me in the church, could I come back on a Sunday and stand up and make my amends? And he said, quote, hell no. You have done enough damage in that church already. Well, I couldn't do it. And it was a burden that I carried. But the step tells me you got to be willing. That's all I had to do. I just had to be ready. We moved down to Florida in a church there. And I picked up the paper one day and I saw that the bishop who was my bishop in North Carolina was now the bishop in Florida. Now, if you're a Methodist, you know the bishop is the head of the church. And my mind began to run, you know, if I could make my amends to the bishop for the wrongs that I did to the people in the church, maybe that'd work. And it sounded pretty good, and I talked to some folks in the program about it, and they said, Ray, that'd be fantastic if you could get the bishop to do it. And I wrote him a long letter. He didn't understand it. But he said, come on over, I'd like to see you again. I went over to Lakeland, sat down with him. 4.5 hours we sat, and I just did a fifth step with that old fellow. And he listened. I told him about adultery committed in the churches. I told him about preaching drunk, preaching intoxicated, ministering the sacraments, lying, cheating, all that stuff. And we got through. He said, Ray, I have never heard that kind of honesty from anybody in my life. And I said, Bishop A.A. has it all the time. We do a lot of fifth steps. We had a prayer. He said, I might need to talk with you. I think I've got somebody that I need to talk with you about. He had identified someone in the church that had a problem. And I went away from there knowing that I had done something that the church allowed me to do, and the church and AA were hooked up. They call me some now, a good bit, from my annual conference, and they ask me to do some seminars, to talk with ministers, to talk with laity about alcoholism and drug addiction. I feel extremely honored to have that privilege. And I owe it all to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that I have today came from you folks. You know, for so long I heard people say, and I could hear it ringing in my ears, you made your bed, boy, sleep in it. But Jesus says, pick up your bed and walk. That's what the charge is. Pick it up and walk and go do what you're supposed to do. And I've tried to do that. Ben and I have probably one of the happiest lives that anybody could ever have. A little rain falls occasionally, but we know how to handle that. We've got a program that allows us to do it. God's been extremely good to us. We are going to retire, not old enough, you can tell that, but we're going to retire at 62, and we're going back to our hometown to retire. I bought a little mill house. Doesn't have a pantry. I don't need one anymore. And we're going to move up there, and what I'm going to do, if God allows us to live, is to work with alcoholics. Not in a treatment setting, but in a recovery setting. Where when the phone rings, you can get up and go get them and work with them. And that's what I want to do. Probably going to work with a lot of drunk preachers if I get that opportunity. I want to thank you again for allowing us to be here. It's been a marvelous experience. My cup runneth over completely. I hate to leave. I'm like Peter, James, and John, I'd like to build a tabernacle right out here on this big tree and stay forever. But there are things to do and people to see and places to go. I love you folks, and God bless you.